Welcome to the Jonah Carey Podcast, friends. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today's guest is Billy Wagner. Yes, Billy Wagner, one of the most dominant relief pitchers of all time. You could argue a worthy Hall of Fame candidate. Truly a magnificent career. And as great a pitcher as he was, man, oh man, does this guy love to teach. He's a high school coach in Virginia at one of the top-rated prep baseball teams in the country, and that's largely thanks to his efforts. He's been tremendous, and there's just so much enthusiasm. I don't even want to hype this up too much or get too far into it. I just want you to listen because, yeah, we talk about his career and the fact that he was, you know, 5'10" and 180 pounds, something like that, breaking into the big leagues and wielding a 97-mile-an-hour fastball, and just the stories he tells about getting Barry Bonds out and stuff like that is great. The playing stuff is great, but you just have to listen to this guy talk about how much he fundamentally loves to teach. And whatever, you know, you get cynical about whatever industry you're in, maybe in athletics too. You get down, you get this, you get that. He's an optimist. He's a people person. This guy makes me want to run through a brick wall. I wish I played high school baseball for him and whatever. I was a terrible baseball player. Okay, basketball, terrible baseball. But yeah, just, I can't even express to you how good I felt after talking to Billy Wagner. I'd never talked to him before. I'd never interviewed him. But it worked out. Thanks to Emigo Lindsey Barnes and his compadres in and around Charlottesville for making this happen, by the way. And yeah, like I said, this was one of those things that just happened to have come about. Thanks largely to Mr. Barnes and some other folks. But it was such a cool chat, and it's so interesting to get to know people that I just don't know anything about, and then we end up talking for an hour, and I feel better for it. And I hope you will, too. I think you'll really, really like this a lot. Hey, let's talk about this week's sponsor, friends. You could probably guess who it is. It's SeatGeek! Of course it's SeatGeek! SeatGeek has been sponsoring me since, I don't know, the Mesozoic era? Is that an era? Probably it's an era. And I mean that in the best way because they've been a fantastic sponsor throughout. Listen, it's the best place to buy or sell tickets to anything you could possibly want to baseball games and hockey games and basketball games and whatever. All of it. SeatGeek has it for you. Color-coded map makes it really easy to use, simple, intuitive. It's fantastic. I am just such a big fan of everything that they do and the way that they go about it. And I've used them a billion, zillion, trillion times. It's really, really a great way to buy or sell tickets to any event that you could possibly want. How about this? Download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code Jonah today, and you'll get $20 off of your first SeatGeek purchase. Yeah, that's right. Download the SeatGeek app, enter the promo code Jonah, and get $20 off of your first SeatGeek purchase. You know what? If you've listened to this podcast regularly, you've heard that promo. Got another one for you. How about this? SeatGeek has a special offer for all MLB purchasers, not just first-timers. First-timer maybe, but even if you're not a first-timer, even if you used SeatGeek before, here it is. Use the promo code CARRY, that's K-E-R-I, and you'll get $10 off of MLB tickets. Yeah, that's right. Promo code CARRY for $10 off MLB tickets. Just go ahead and use promo code JONAH, again, for $20 off of any first-time purchase, baseball or not, but $10 off of MLB tickets, regardless of whether this is the first time you're using SeatGeek or the 10,000th time you've used SeatGeek. And if you have used it 10,000 times, you should email me and tell me because that's pretty good. Yeah, use SeatGeek. They're fantastic. Thank you, SeatGeek, for sponsoring the podcast. Quick programming notes, CBS Sports is where you will find me doing lots and lots of video. If you go to cbssports.com, you'll find a link at the bottom of the page for HQ. HQ is our 24-hour streaming service. It's digital video. I am talking about baseball constantly on that platform. Listen to me there. I'll be writing for CBS Sports throughout the season as well from time to time. Probably a little bit more video than writing, but you'll get writing from me there. And sportsnet.ca is the other place where you'll find a lot of my writing. Every Thursday, writing about the Jays, typically from an analytical angle. Sometimes it's not about the Jays, but often about the Jays. And we'll see what else comes down the pike as the year goes on. I imagine I'll jump into some other things too. So check all of that out. Check out this episode of the Jonah Carey Podcast as well. It is with Billy Wagner. Enjoy. Jonah, Jonah, Jonah. All right, very excited to have on the podcast the terrific longtime Major League relief pitcher and possible Hall of Fame candidate, Billy Wagner. How are you?
I'm doing great, Dennis.
Oh, it's great to have you on, and the story of your career is such a great one. You think of some of the really imposing and devastating pitchers that have come up through history. You were not that guy. You're coming out of high school about 5'10", 170, and built this great career. And even before that, I want to start by talking a little bit about your childhood, you know, coming up a little bit, and how, you know, oftentimes the paths of players will be laced with various challenges along the way. And I know for you, it wasn't always easy. You know, how did you navigate the path just in terms of your parents having a tough time and, you know, money being tight and trying to find your way as a budding athlete, but also just as a human being, as a kid?
In broad strokes, I guess we're all, as human beings, we're all placed with obstacles in our life. And it's based on how, you know, how we handle these obstacles is kind of how we make our life, how we go about becoming successful or going down the wrong path. And so one thing my parents, you know, it wasn't the happy-go-lucky childhood as everybody could imagine. But it was it wasn't that I didn't feel, you know, my parents were divorced when I was five, remarried. It was abusive ex-spouses, but there was a love factor. I knew that my parents loved me, and you know, by having this, they also gave me options. I had great grandparents that took me in and gave me what I needed. I had an aunt and uncle who adopted me before I went into high school and gave me the opportunity to play sports. My cousin was a huge role model for me and allowed me to see a work ethic.
Well, sure, and I have to imagine that would come in handy as well. Your cousin, in particular, Jeff Lamey, was a terrific athlete in his own right, right? I mean, so I have to imagine, you know, work ethic and also just having a role model. You know, if when you're coming up as an athlete, and again, as a human being, having somebody to look up to, whether it's an older sibling, cousin, you know, maybe a friend or whatever, would seem to come in handy. Sounds like he started in your life, but really solidified his role in your life just at the right time.
Well, you know, I always felt like God had a huge hand in everything I did, whether I, you know, forced the issue or not. And my faith has been huge for how I go about decisions and right or wrong. Being able to use my faith as a repent or a guidance. So, it just seems like every opportunity I had to go down the wrong path, there was someone, Eric Robinson or Jeff Lamey or somebody that was there that was going to keep me in the right path. And then of course, meeting my wife and her having such an influence on me, yeah, it did change my outlook, and that frustrated teen years of you know, of being undersized, being undervalued, those things. And so having all those obstacles, I think it's helped me to you know, to guide more teens. My high school coach Lou Peary was a huge role model for me as not looking down at size. I think teens today they're so forced to look a certain way, be a certain way, to be an athlete, that it's really hard to for them to see value in themselves if they're not reaching certain goals. And so that my coach in high school and my college coach and some of the experiences I had growing up and going to pro baseball, you know, made me want to be more of a coach and a mentor to these kids, because I wanted to show that there's more to value than being a big leaguer or feeling like that's the only path that they could have. So, that has been what I felt, you know, God has asked me to do, and hopefully, in some capacity, I've done it in a subpar manner for the kids.
Absolutely, and I definitely want to get to more of the discussion of your role at the Miller School of Albemarle and how you've been able to contribute on that level and later on in the conversation as well. I want to touch on the stature thing, the size thing, because I think that's so interesting. You know, I've done podcasts with like Shaquille O'Neal. You know what I mean? Shaquille O'Neal was never like, well, I'm undersized. I don't think it's going to work for me. I think he had an inkling that things would go well. You were a great athlete by all accounts, but you know, being a little bit on the small side in high school, I'm wondering about that, about when you think that the switch flipped. I know in your senior year, you had this huge season, not only as a pitcher, but gosh, you had 450 and stole a bunch of bases, and you were really just a great all-around athlete. Was it around that time that you thought, oh, gee, I can make a go of this and maybe make some money professionally? Or was it still like, okay, I'm in Virginia, I'm doing my thing, I'll go to college, let's see what happens. Where did you stand in terms of your aspirations at that point?
Well, I think it's funny because I don't know if there was aspirations because of, I think everybody wanted to play pro baseball.
Sure.
You know, I think that's the, you know, what, I mean, in Southwest Virginia, it's almost that thought of, you know, probably, yeah, I'd love to, you know, but it's not one of those thoughts that you go, well, you know, that's probably going to happen.
Right.
But I think that I never put myself in a situation to think about tomorrow. What you know, what could tomorrow bring? It was, I'm going to work hard today. I'm going to play hard today. I'm going to do the best I can today. And I'm going to overcome whatever I got to do today. And you know, so, you know, when you have the people around you that are the critics, instead of for me going, using it as a opportunity to go, oh, well, you're probably right. I'm not going to be successful, and I'm not going to have this opportunity. I use that as a, you know, as that little tip on the shoulder to go, well, I'll show you.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, because the good thing is, as little as everybody has pointed that I was compared to everybody else, it's never been about the height and size. It's been about the heart and desire to compete and go out there and achieve. You know, for the most part, you got to have the opportunity. And I've been many times blessed over with the opportunity of going out there and being able to put myself in a successful situation by going to a small school and playing with some great players like Eric Owens and people that got drafted out of Ferrum. And so bringing that attention, then having the opportunity to go to Cape Cod League and becoming a player and seeing the outside world instead of just seeing that small Virginia part of the world, I got to see more of the country and the talent. And you know, once you go out there and you're able to compete with those guys, then, you know, I think those are things that kind of open up things. But for me, being on welfare, living you know, day to day, not knowing, you know, if you're having a meal or these things will happen. You know, I never took it as a luxury of thinking about, I'm going to, you know, this is all going to work out. I'm going to be in the big leagues. I'm going to make millions of dollars and all this. It was never about that. It was, if I get to play, you know, I'm going to play as hard today. And if I get to play tomorrow, I'm going to play as hard as I can tomorrow. And so it was really you know, maybe it's just that dumb, naive, kid from Southwest Virginia who didn't put, you know, I wasn't trying to look at the bigger picture and make more out of it. It was more of me just saying, you know what, this is who I am. You know, I'm an overachiever. I'm going to go out there and continue to overachieve. And when you tell me I can't, I'm going to outwork you. And so those are things, but I think those are things that were given to me from my high school coach, from my cousin, and some of the great athletes that were around me that, you know, inspired me to be more and not to settle for just being, you know, average. And so that was some things for me that, you know, helped me push through the whole, push through the whole size thing. Because that was, I never felt as small as everybody wanted to make me feel. And you know, those are the things that probably inspired me to want to be better because, everybody wants to know why this is possible. Everybody wants to know. And sometimes it's just, you know, God bless you. And I've got a, you know, being a natural right-hander and throwing left-handed, there is no, you know, that in itself speaks volumes about, you know, the, you know, what, you know, God had placed for me to give me that opportunity. But I think, you know, for me, having all these experiences to be able to look back at, and it was very easy for me to be bitter and choose so many different things. I think that, you know, that's why choosing to go down to be a mentor and doing things like that and fight for the opportunities to be a big leaguer and the right to belong or feel like you belong, you know, that was probably for me not even a, it was a no-brainer for me.
Absolutely. Just to put a, for the listeners, by the way, since you cited a couple of these things, number one, Billy broke his right arm twice as a young kid, you know, three, 4, 5 years old.
Yeah.
And ended up throwing left-handed as a result. So that's a pretty interesting origin story. And then Ferrum College, this is a Division III liberal arts college, a fine school, but not necessarily UCLA or Texas or Stanford. And, you know, you mentioned yourself, Ann Owens, coming out of there. And you're being slightly modest, too. Billy set all-time records, NCAA records, I believe that still stand. Most strikeouts per 19 for nine innings, 19 strikeouts per nine innings, and fewer than two hits allowed per nine innings. You were unhittable. So Ferrum College, which might not have been a powerhouse necessarily, certainly became known once you and Eric really stepped to the fore, which was a pretty interesting phenomenon in its own right.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I followed my cousin to Ferrum, and yeah. I actually went to Ferrum to play football. I love football. I don't. I mean, you talking about being undersized? Go to play
nose
Ferrum.
Tackle, right? That's where you're going to play.
I was a defensive back.
Also, not a nose and, tackle. You're not going to play nose tackle at 5'10", 170.
No. That would have been clearly undersized. But being a defensive back, I was fast at the time, and so you know, being playing that role was good, but I. After a season being beat around and things like that, my defensive back coach Dave Davis, probably one of the smartest men I've known, and I highly have always respected him. He came and watched me pitch, and after the game, he met me in the dugout, and we walked down to the locker room, and he just told me that he goes, you know, you'll probably play your 4 years of football at Ferrum and, and things, but you're not going to the NFL. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have a real career opportunity for baseball. And he goes, but now if you decide that you still want to play football, he goes, I'm not going to let you hit, but I am going to run you. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to get you in the best shape to be a baseball player. Huh. And so it was one of those, you know, guys that just was looking out for me that saw more I thought more about me, and it was a great decision made for me to take this opportunity. But you know, it was I thought that I love football. Football was probably my passion before baseball. But once I really bought in and said, hey, I'm gonna do it. People are starting to see it. But you know, still at that point, really not really knowing if you were that good. You know, I don't think I ever really visioned myself as being really that good. It was just, I'm good for there, being at Ferrum. I didn't really look at the records and stuff like that to go, oh, that's good. Because, you know, it's really easy to say, oh, you know, it's Division III. But, you know, when you think about it, at that point in our conference, we had North Carolina Wesleyan, who was coached by UNC now's coach Mike Fox.
Yeah.
And so you had, I mean, we were ranked always in the top five in the nation. They were ranked in the top five in the nation. And then our other conference opponent, Methodist, was ranked in the top five in the nation. So it wasn't like you were going to play at just, you know, a small college. You were playing at a very strong baseball school. So, you know, that kind of prepared you, but you didn't realize, I mean, I didn't realize that any of this was possible coming out of Ferrum. And then I think going to Cape Cod made a big difference, but that's when I got the national exposure. But even at that point, or even really after I got drafted, it was more, I'm just going to play baseball. I wasn't thinking about what the money was going to do for me. It was just really, I never had that issue. I think, and I think that's because I really never put that type of expectation on myself, where today these kids put such expectations on themselves to go and pitch Division I, play for UVA, play for some of these schools. Yeah. And so they really, are short-sighted and they can't value themselves when UVA doesn't call them or these schools don't call, major schools don't call them. And they see these Division IIs and IIIs and JUCOs as, you know, smaller, you know, lesser schools. But in all honesty, these are probably the schools that more of these kids need to invest themselves in than the Division I's, because they need that development. And so trying to talk to these kids, they need people that have been there and done that and have not always went to the bigger schools and become successful to explain and mentor them and say, this is a good path. These are good ways to get to where you want to and get the education and the push just as much as going to the stronger D1 schools. But, you know, but that's sort of, you know, trying to have that role for these kids to kind of talk to. Because at Miller, I've been very blessed with a ton of talent, kids that have come through the organization that are, when they start, you know, they all tell me the same thing. They want to play, you know, pro baseball. They want to be Division I, and I love it because I'm like, hey, you know what? That's great. That's what I want you to do. We're going to push and fight and go there. And then, you know, as we get closer, we'll make these decisions. But it's, you know, I guess my reputation I'm just not very, very good at gray areas. So I'm not one to sit there and I'm not one to blow your dreams and stuff up, because I had plenty of those people trying to blow my dreams up. And so that's been another step that's allowed me to talk to these kids and be honest with them. You know, I think these kids respond better to the honesty now rather than getting to that college level and then all of a sudden just being blown up and not understanding, this is the world we live in, and it makes it harder for them. So we sit down and have these discussions about schools, and you know, sometimes they're like they can't believe that, you know, these aren't options. And you know, but soon after that, they've been able to realize, hey, you know, this has worked out better for me. And you know, there's nothing worse than hearing something that you don't want to hear. So but you know, we have talks and we work things out, and you know, we work to get them to where they want to be. But you know, ultimately, it's just to let them know that I've been there and that, you know, I'm here to make you successful. This has not got anything to do with me being successful, because whether we win state championships in high school or not, it's not really, that's not my goal. I played the highest level, so I'm not here for that. I'm here to really help teach kids how to play baseball, how to be good young men, how to manage their time and help them through some of their tough teenage decisions at this point. And I think all the things that I've went through and the path that God has put in front of me and stuff, and the people that have been there to help me, have allowed me to be able to take this role for these kids. And so these are the great things. Even all the accomplishments I've had, the greatest accomplishment I'll have is giving each kid the opportunity by not being in that gray area and just being honest with them. And every day we're honest with each other. I mean, I think when they learn how to self-evaluate themselves to a point, because most of these kids today can't value themselves, because if they haven't hit four home runs in the game and are not throwing 95 by their sophomore year and not committed, they're awful. So teaching them how to value themselves too, it within that black and white manner is a challenge, but I think it pays off, because the kids know what they get or what I see. And you know, and this isn't something I just kind of throw off the cuff and say, you know, you're D1 or you're not, or you're this or you're that. It, you know, this is things down the road. I mean, I don't tell a a sophomore kid that he's a D1 player during practice when he's a sophomore.
Yeah.
So, you know, he goes, "Coach, do you think I can play at this school?" I'm like, "Yeah, I think you play at this school. But, you know, you're 2 years away from ever worrying about this. So worry about today." And so those are the things I try to work with and enjoy today, and your work today will create a positive tomorrow.
What do you think the role of roving organizations, events, tournaments, stuff like Perfect Games, you know, the academies and all that stuff? You are coaching, you know, kind of more traditional high school baseball. You have a school, you have a team, you're going to coach. But you see these organizations like Perfect Game and others, and they seem committed to being showcases. You know, that it's about, can this kid throw 98? That it's about, can this kid, you know, let's measure the measurables and all that. And it's a split. It seems like it's a split opinion in the industry. On the one hand, you can develop skills that way. But on the other hand, a lot of the things that you talked about, which is kind of a combination of confidence and humility, the combination of being aggressive but also understanding that development takes time, they're not that patient at those other places. Where do you come down on all that stuff, which has become such a huge part of amateur baseball?
Well,
you can be honest on the show.
Well, it's funny because I coach a travel team.
Okay.
And I'll be the first to say it's the necessary evil.
Yeah.
Now, the travel team that I'm coaching is one of those that gets to practice. You get to develop. They're kids. They're not from 10 different states. They're more of the local, maybe a couple hours away from you type of area. So, I've coached the national teams for the FSU Canes. I've done some of these things. And what I noticed is that the talent is tremendous. There is so much talent in America with baseball.
Hmm.
But there is absolutely no IQ to how to play it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that comes from, you know, I think Perfect Game makes it is great. I think you know, the Under Armour, the PBR, all these rankings are great for college coaches.
Yes.
They're not great for college players or wanting to be college players because you can't value yourself. There's not that team concept. I mean, all these colleges want these great athletes, but really what the top 25, you know, 30 high Division I schools want is the minor league reject coming out of high school who is probably going to go pro, but they want a minor league team.
Yeah.
And they like these cookie cutters. And so they really look at the top 100 lists and they go, "Oh, I'm going to go after these guys." Well, a lot of your talent or your developed are kids that aren't as developed at that point. They have size, but they don't have, they're long and lanky. And so a lot of these kids, I mean, it's really hard for these kids to go to these events because you can be good, a very good player. You can run well, you can hit well, throw well, you can do well and have a bad week and not even get a look. But you can really have that week where you go out there and you've had a terrible summer and all of a sudden you go to a Perfect Game and you hit 3 home runs and you do just some things that kind of, and people are just all over you. So it's really hard because it's not that team. It's not a real team situation. So it puts a lot of pressure on the individuals. And I mean, in Virginia, there's I don't know the number, but talking to other coaches, there's a huge suicide rate going on right now with these kids so stressed out about, you know, getting to college and not getting to college, getting to a T1 college.
Yeah.
And so it really affects how you talk to these kids and how they see themselves. And, you know, I think that the Perfect Games and the showcases have allowed only one thing, and it's selfish, that's un-IQ'd, or and for your colleges to make it so easy to see these kids. They can see them. They can't tell if they're a good ball player. They can tell if they've got good bat speed. They can tell if they throw hard. They can tell if they run. But they really have a hard time seeing if they even know how to play the game. And, you know, in college baseball, is so awesome, but it's changed the whole dynamics of baseball in general, because most college baseball players have such a learning curve if they ever go pro that it takes them a while, because the college coaches now are so pressured to win that development is really out the window. I mean, every pitching coach tells every catcher what to tell what pitcher, and every pitching coach wants the same pitcher out on the mound. They all look the same. There's no difference. Every batting style is this type of batting style. And the uniqueness of the game is that you can have a Louis Tiant and a Nolan Ryan and you know, Andy Pettit or a Jeff Bagwell, a Moises Alou, and Bryce Harper, because they're all different.
So different.
But now it's become so cookie cutter that everybody, it makes everything easier to coach. And so you really don't develop. You go, this is how we want to do it, because it's easy for everybody to get. And so it's just the whole game has really gotten difficult, because you're kind of hand-fed everything you need to do. I mean, every catcher is told what pitch to call, because pretty much the pitching coach or the head coach is telling that catcher, you really don't know what you're doing. And by the way, you know, I'm making $250,000, and if I lose, I could get fired. And, you know, I don't want to hinge my job on a 17-year-old kid who's very talented but doesn't know the game quite yet. And I ain't got time to really teach him, because, you know, NCAA regulations and things like that. So there is so much involved in this. And now, for me, I feel like I have to talk to these our players so much more about how to work at the plate, and how to make the decisions and simplify things for them, because when they get to college, it's such a as a freshman, if you roll in there and you don't make a splash right away, you may not see the field again. They'll be done with you.
Yeah.
So it's really trying to create this setting and let them know their value and how to make adjustments and how to go about their business. But you know, the game itself is awesome. Perfect games. It's great to watch this talent. It's there's nothing better. And I'm down there every year. I'll be down there for 2 weeks at Lake Point, and I'm going to watch these kids go out there and the Abu Shield Canes national team, American team. They're going to have guys going 95,
yeah,
maybe even 100 miles an hour, and that's awesome. I think that's great. But the thing that's really fun is when I watch that kid throwing 80, 83, but getting everybody out, and he knows how to pitch. Now, those are the things, but that coach from the big major school or something, they're not gonna be there.
Yeah.
And if a Division III school was to roll in there to talk to a kid, that kid wouldn't give him the time of day, because their whole goal is for that Division I school. And unfortunately, you know, I try to play the mediator to a lot of these situations with these kids, saying that, you know, you want to just get on the field. You want to play. You want to play another, you know, going to college for your academics. If you're able to do it through baseball, you just want to play another 4 years and then let those things take care of itself. But I mean, if you want to play at these higher schools, there is a difference. And when you go to perfect game, it is a very selfish situation, because the college coach wants to see. They want to see all these, you know, spin rates and launch angles and all these new terms that, to me, are the same terms we use as he can hit or he can't, or he can get somebody out or he can't.
Right.
Those are all those terms, but it's made sexy by some of the people that's never played, or way to, you know, make this game even more sophisticated, when it's really it's not. So, there is such a game within the game now.
Two things strike me about your answer. Number one, first of all, wow, do you have enthusiasm for the game? I was smiling listening to your answer, talking about kids and how excited you are to go watch kids compete. So that's great. But number two, I actually just did a podcast with Chris Spire. Spire broke into the big leagues in the early 70s, played 19 years, very good ball player, 3-time All-Star. And he subsequently coached a bunch of different teams and managed in the minors, coached in the majors. And he said that he was managing at A-ball one year. And, you know, everybody teaches base running and Managers get frustrated that teams aren't that happens all the time. That's one of the most maddening things. I'm sure you could speak to it as well. That if, you know, somebody messes up, doesn't go first to third, whatever, it drives you nuts. And he said that he was so frustrated that the kids, he wasn't mad at the kids. He just felt that they weren't self-empowered. He felt that they didn't have the tools to know what was right and what was wrong, because it was so, as you said, force-fed to them to some extent. This is how you're going to play. This is how you're going to do it, or whatever. So what he did was he actually basically didn't manage for a week. He said, you know what, guys? And he wasn't doing it out of frustration. He said, let's see what happens for a week if him and his top assistant just kind of take the reins off. And kids learned so much, he said, in that 1 week. They figured out, you know what, you got to cut the bag a little tighter. You know, if the ball's in, if you see it in front of you, take the extra base. It was an amazing thing about that. So I'm wondering, from your perspective at Miller and travel teams, how do you strike that balance? Because on the one hand, gosh, you have a lot of expertise. I mean, you're one of the greatest relief pitchers in the history of baseball. But on the other hand, if kids can teach themselves, that would seem to be such a valuable tool.
I think that's the ultimate tool. I think as a coach, that's what that's how you should be valuing yourself. Is, you know, I've taught you these the game. Now, how you got to have an instinct. These kids need to have an instinct to the game. Mm. If you, and it goes back to the hand fed. If I'm telling you what to throw, when to throw, how to throw it, and you're never asked to really make these adjustments or see things for yourself, then how do you really grow? Because now you don't know the questions to ask, and you don't. And so, and so, like our catcher this year, Adam Hackenberg, he's looked to be going the first couple rounds of the draft. He's a catcher. He's going to Clemson. Yeah, the best thing I can do for that kid is to give him boundaries, and all I can do is to polish a little bit. The other stuff is, you call the game. Now, I'm not going to get mad if you mess up, but I want to know, when I ask you a question, why. I want to know why and what you're thinking, because if you can't ask me the right question of why and how, then we can't get better. I want you to understand what you're looking for. I want you to make the mistake so that you can get better, because you can't get better if you just, you know, you can't make the mistakes. But I also want you to have that fearlessness that I'm going to make this call, and if it works, great. If it doesn't, you know what? I'm, you know, this is what I saw, and I don't have to worry about this coach. Well, nowadays, holy cow, I can't even imagine a catcher getting the opportunity to make this call in a situation that that could cost you a game or get into the playoffs or something like that. But because, you know, it's, you know, you haven't had to make that decision.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important for kids to have the leniency to make the error, to make the mistake, so that you can coach. I think you have to coach the basics. I think you talk through the game. But I also think, for me, what I like to do, and I really try hard, is to have my practices is very, very developmental. This is what we're working on. This is what I want to do. And when we break it down to work on, this is why we're doing it. Now, in the games, I'm going to give you suggestions. I have suggestions for bunts. I have everything. I tell them, you know, there's only like three signs that are mandatory. You have to do it when you're hitting. And so, you know, if it's a sack situation, a hit and run, or a take.
Yeah.
But, you know, those situations dictate, and for the most part, I do not enjoy the game because I'm looking at the developmental part of it, and so I'm just sitting back and I'm writing notes. Half the time I forget to get a sign because I'm sitting here watching. You know what? He needs to get this. He needs to get a bigger lead. He needs to do this, because the game is bigger than the game right now for me. I need you to get better, and the guys that have went on for me. Like a Tanner Morse or a Will Wagner, or guys that went through the whole system, like Mike Daly, and guys that went on to play college ball and are going to be successful, are the ones that were given that opportunity to mess up. Just do your thing. Go get your go make your mistake. Don't go first to third, you know, or just so that you're able to learn from it. Because the coaches don't go, why aren't you going that way? This is right here. Now they're going to be able to look at it. Now I'm going to play safe because I'm going to play not to lose. And when you play not to lose, you might as well have quit. So I think those opportunities of playing apprehensive and things have gotten in the way. And I think that for all the things that we want to talk about as far as everyone getting to play in Little League and getting a medal to feel self-valued has affected all these things of, I don't want to make an error. I don't want to make a bad throw. I don't want to lose. I don't want to do this. And so they are so emotionally challenged before they get there. So they're going to play it safe. I'm not going to take a swing that, you know, I could possibly hit a home run, but what if? They always play that, what if I fail, instead of the what if I go about and I get that base hit or I do these things. And, you know, giving them boundaries to understand so that they can grow within those boundaries and knowing that, hey, if a guy's 3-0 on you and you're down by two runs, you know, you don't take this wild swing, you know, when there's nobody on. You know, you just try to teach them through having a good conversation, but through examples. And but they've got to experience that situation, the anxiety of it being on their shoulders and then maybe not coming through, and that the coach comes up and pats them on the butt and goes, hey, I want you there tomorrow. Or, yep. You know, or the kid who doesn't handle the situation well and, you know, maybe, you know, just his frustration gets out and so he loses his poise. But those are all things that we as coaches in high school have to allow to happen so that we can allow them to grow. We are so conscious in how that reflects into the coaches. Oh, he's not coached very well. Well, yeah, I don't want my kid out there F-bombing umpires and showing people up and doing things like that. But I also want them to be okay to voice their opinion and have passion in what they do within reason. So, you know, I think there's such a long line of why the game has gotten to the point and why kids feel this, I guess this apprehension when they play the game sometimes. Because when the real kids go out there and they're very aggressive and they play, they're the ones who get the playing time.
I'm going to bounce back and forth a little bit just because I'm so fascinated by both the teaching element of your life and career and your playing element. And I want to return to playing for one second. It's an interesting, I don't know that I've ever asked this question before. And I've interviewed so many ex-pitchers, especially. I'm just fascinated by pitching. And so I'm scared that I'm going to ask this question and the answer is going to be, I don't know. I was just able to do it, but I'm going to ask anyway. You know, I played mostly basketball growing up. I played 1 year of Little League. I was terrible. And, you know, even guys who go along and they play high school, they play college or whatever, to get to the point where you can actually throw 99 miles an hour, let alone throw with command, let alone have a hammer, you know, breaking pitch, whatever, it feels like a superpower to me. It's just, there are not that many human beings in the history of the world that can throw 98, 99, 100. So I guess I want to ask you, and again, maybe the answer is, I don't know, it's God-given, and I'm okay with that if that's the answer, but how does that happen, and what does that feel like to know that you're standing on the mound, and if you want to, you can throw 99 miles an hour?
Well, I think that's one of the biggest questions ever that's asked to me consistently.
Yeah.
How could you do that? How did you do that?
Yeah.
Well, when I came out of high school, I'm throwing 78 miles an hour to 80 miles an hour. I mean, I was effectively wild. I'm 5'5", 135 pounds, rolling out of high school. Then I get to college and I go to play football. And I grow because I'm really in the weight room and maturity kind of finally hits because I'm a late bloomer. So now I'm a whopping like 5'9", 170 pounds. So, and with that, my velocity changed. Now my first year in college ball, I'm 92, 95. Okay. Now I'm still effectively wild. And so I was given my coach allowed me to grow with that. And so he didn't overcoach me. He let me learn it. So I guess the answer to your question is a little bit of, you know, it's God given, but I also think it's, for me, it was also a fear of failure. And I use Eckersley's line because I think it is really emphatic to what I was feeling. I didn't want to lose. I didn't want to be embarrassed. I didn't want to feel like I wasn't accepted or should have been there or having that. And so that fear of failure that created that more. Now, I'll be honest with you, there are so many times I go, man, I couldn't tell you how hard I was going. Because that was not, I could never rate myself. What raised myself was if that guy swung and missed or if we won the game. Because there's so many times that I didn't have very good stuff and I won, and there's times I had very good stuff and I didn't. I didn't do well. So I don't know if, you know, there is this, you know, this scientific measure of why things are, but that's why, to me, baseball is so awesome. Because you can't explain everything, and I don't want to explain everything. I don't want instant replay because, you know what, I want Joe West behind the mat, behind the plate, and you know what? And you're battling to make that pitch, and you know what? I want those things. You know, I know the game would be the game is perfect without it being perfect, and so those are the things why I watch a Roy Oswalt go out there and throw 97, and then throw an 82 mile an hour curveball with the same mechanics. It's just to me is amazing. Mm-hmm. Or watch. Watch Pedro Martinez go out and do what he did, and watch Roger Clemens or the unit or these types of guys go out and do what they do. But you know what? There's no stature limit here. You know what? We did what we did because that's just, you know, that's what we were blessed to do. And you know how we got there is crazy. Roy Oswalt told me that he got his superpower for throwing hard because he was trying to jumpstart a battery in a tractor, and it shocked him.
I mean, that literally sounds like Marvel Comics.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that's the neatness of the game.
Yeah.
They're watching a baseball game where every guy comes out and throws 95 to 100 miles an hour is not fun. Yeah. Or every hitter comes out there and stands in the box the same way. There's nothing to that. Where you go out there and you got Craig Biggio or Moises Alou I like that difference. I like that, you know, and you know what? I don't need to be 6'5", 6'10" to throw 100 miles an hour. I don't have to be, this size to hit a home run. I put the bat on the ball I got a guy throwing hard and I put the good part of the bat on the ball. It's probably going to go out anyway. So, I mean, I think that all those things that have really that was my thing. I remember stepping in facing Barry Bonds and Matt Williams and my catcher, and I had bases loaded, one out in the Astrodome, and I remember Randy Moore walking out and me goes, "Hey, we're going to do 6 fastballs here, and we're going to the house."
All right,
and I threw 6 fastballs, and we went to the house.
Oh man!
So with 2 punch outs, that game was just something. Now that I didn't have to be 6'10" to achieve that.
Yeah,
I had to have that naive, stupid. Hey, you're facing Barry Bonds and Matt Williams, and who cares? Here we go. You know, it was I want to win, and my catcher believes in me. And that's what I'm here to do. I'm here to get you out, and you know, and as nervous and as much anxiety and fear of failure that I had at that point, that drove me to be able to do what I was able to do. And you know, maybe there is no rhyme or reason to why I was able to do what I was able to do. I mean, but I was able to do it, and you know, so. There's a ton of opinions that relievers, it's not a big thing and stuff, but there's two guys that I really, really love to hear because they were a starter and they were relievers, and Eckersley and Smoltz were probably two of the greatest relievers I've ever,
sure.
relievers/starters ever. And I remember sitting in the bullpen in the All-Star game with John Smoltz, who, by all means, I love Mariano Rivera, but if John Smoltz decided he wanted to be just a closer, he would have been the greatest ever.
Oh, he was insanely good.
His stuff was phenomenal. But I remember sitting there watching him getting ready for the game, and he was a wreck, chewing his knuckles. And,
wow.
I mean, he's nervous. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that to me was when I finally went, you know what? I really like this game much more, because that's how I feel before I go out. The passion of those games and the passion that each individual brings is different, but that's what makes the game so awesome.
I love all that. Smoltz, a former podcast guest of mine, too. I love talking to him. He's such an interesting guy. I want to ask you, totally is. I want to ask you, just to follow up on that point a little bit, you know, in the modern era, and maybe this goes back, it feels like this was something that existed before and now we've come back to it. It's not quite as specialized as it was. When you were called on, you were usually up, you know, 1 to 3 runs, bases empty, ninth inning. Maybe you're closing out the eighth, but for the most part, you're a traditional closer. Now you've got guys coming in the seventh, and you've got guys coming in tie games, you know, at home and what have you. It's not quite as straight up, let's let this guy get 45 saves as it used to be. It's about, what do they say, high leverage situations and things like that. And as somebody who was there, who was in the trenches, who heard his own closer music, who ran to the mound, you know, vein popping and all that stuff, and was like, okay, here we go 6 times and we're going to the house. What do you make of that? Can you get up the same way not knowing exactly what your role is going to be on a certain night? Are you a fan of the closer orthodoxy? Or as a coach or even as an ex-pitcher, do you believe, all right, he's my hammer out of the bullpen, I'm going to use him whatever, in the fifth and the ninth, I don't care?
Oh, I believe that if a pitcher, whether he's a closer, middleman, or whatever, knows what his role is.
Yeah.
And that role is, you know, you could pitch anywhere from the seventh to the ninth, whatever part that I need you. And I know as a pitcher that I have to be ready at that point. Mm. From that point on, then I don't think it's a problem. Okay. I think you go out and do. My first save ever was a three inning save.
Oh wow! Jeez.
So if that was how that was supposed to be for the rest of my career, and that's how I knew to do it, that's how I would do it. It wouldn't be the oh, you can only pitch an inning, but as it turned out, you were an inning to an inning and a third type guy, and this was it. And so those were the parameters. And so, you know, I've always thought it doesn't matter when you use it, it's how you use them and if they know about it. If you're the closer and you've been a one-inning closer your whole life, and all of a sudden they call down in the seventh inning until you get ready, you're not ready. You're not going to be ready. And you can say, well, it's just baseball. It's the same thing. It's not the same thing, because we're creatures of habit. We are those guys who are going to go out there, and that you have this routine, and this is how you do it. Now, if you go, hey, you know what, you got to be ready from 7 to 9. Okay, got you. Let's go to work. Hey, this is my job description. I know that. And so, and that was Goose Gossage. That was Fingers. Those were guys. But when Eckersley got there and they said, you're one inning guy. Okay. And then, you know, Mariano, you're an inning. You were behind Whelan, so you pitched maybe the seventh eighth. Well, he knew the seventh eighth was ready for him, and he knew that Whelan was going to get the ninth. But if you are groomed to do that then you're not going to have that issue. But, you know, your standards of who is qualified as a closer or what do the numbers really mean, then I think that changes discussions. I don't think you take Andrew Miller and tell him he's not as good because he only got 207 saves when in his career, but man, this guy was dominant.
Oh yeah,
he was dominant. So I think you have to make a decision on what is the role. And so if, you know, from my era and Trevor and Franco and our heirs, it was one inning. That was sort of how it was. Yeah. And you had, you know, two dominating setup guys that got you the ball, and you went out there and did your thing. Now, you know, that was the luxury. I had Dotel and Lidge, or I had Mike Jackson and Flash. I had, you know, I had some dominating setup men. But, you had those guys for that reason. And your starters, we didn't have starters like, we had with Nolan, and those would go out there and throw 145 pitches a game and come back 4 or 5 days later and do it again. You didn't have those guys. If you had a starter that, with the Mets, when I was there, if we had a guy who went over six innings, buddy, we were in great shape. And that's the way the game was. You play to the sixth inning, and then all your relievers are in there. So, you had to be careful because you didn't carry as many relievers, and you had specialized relievers. So if you put guys in a certain situation, he was gonna probably be down for a day or two. And so, if the manager comes out and tells you that when you come to that organization or when you show up, this is how I want to use you, and this is, I'm gonna tell you right now, there's not a pitcher that goes, if he's groomed to go that way, then he's that, okay, let's go. But you can't take a one inning guy and decide, okay, you're gonna start pitching, when you're 35, you've been there for 10, 12 years, and you go, okay, you're gonna start pitching, be ready in that seventh, and you may pitch the seventh, eighth, ninth. Hey, that ain't gonna work. But it's about being groomed to that point. But I think if you groom them, do it. I think watching these guys go out there and really dominate for three innings is more impressive than the guy maybe for one, except that if that guy pitches three innings and throws a lot of pitches, well, he ain't going to pitch for another 2-3 days.
Yeah.
But if I pitch one inning, I may pitch 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, and to your point.
It's really whatever way you want to do it, and you can draw the conclusion that this isn't, they're over, anybody can pitch that night. Well, there's been a lot of people say that, and there's been only a few that can go out there and say they've done it consistently year after year after year after year. And those are the things that everybody says. You ask any manager, they'll say the same stuff. Well, it doesn't matter. Anybody can do it until all of a sudden the guys that keep running out there can. And then they'll say, oh man, we need a closer.
No doubt.
That's just the way the game is. But I do believe that if you can have that luxury of having that guy and go out there and pitch in 2-3 innings, and he can do it on a basis sort of like Goose, and mm-hmm. those guys are great. But you better have two of them because he's going to be down for a couple of days. And if he's not, then, great. He's Superman.
To your point, by the way, one of my favorite pitchers to watch in all baseball, another Astro, Chris Devensky. Man, did I love him last year in particular. Breakout season, that hammer change up, and just, I'll go out and throw 2 2/3. And, it really is something that a guy comes into a game in the fifth and carries you into the eighth, and then it's, all right, we've built our 4-run lead and we're good. It really is something. I much respect for guys like that, as well as traditional closers, but I like that role. I think it's pretty interesting.
I think it's probably, you can probably get more out of your pitchers because, they have to be more pitchers.
Yeah.
To me, they have to be more pitchers. I mean, I was a two-pitch pitcher, and I came out there, and there was no question what I was going to throw and how I was going to throw it and where I was going to throw it.
Yeah.
Here you go. If you can hit it, you can beat me good, here you go. I mean, same with Mariano, same with Trevor. I mean,
Mariano had one pitch.
But I mean, you're forced to be a whole lot different player when you're in that situation. And you know what? I don't know why they got away from that. And but I don't think that either way you should be penalized. Mm. Either way, as being what you are is what you are. I have no decision on. I could never go and tell my manager, hey, you know what? I should be throwing three innings every 3 days. Those are things that they decided. Wasn't something that, it wasn't, Billy Wagner only pitches one inning or Mariano can only pitch this or that. It's hey, you're the manager. You created this thing. So it's what it is, bud.
One last question for you. It was interesting the way you ended your career. I think back to David Ortiz, who just ended his career recently, and man, he went out with a bang. I mean, he was so good in his final season, and much the same with you. Your final season, you end up with the Braves, you meet your hero Dale Murphy, which is already the coolest, and Murphy's I've got to chat with him a little bit. I love that guy too, as a big fan. And you pitch for the Braves, You strike out 104 batters in 69 and a third. You save a whole bunch of games, 37 games, and you strike out the last four batters that you face in the big leagues. And at a time when you make the All-Star team for the seventh time, crushing everybody, pitching like you're 25, you're like, no, I'm good. I'm all set. I'm leaving. What goes into a decision like that? Because, you know, some players will look at it and say, oh, gosh, I got five more years left in me, and you're saying, nope, I think it's run its course. I'm going out on top, and that's about it. What mentally goes through your mind as you're trying to make that decision where you probably could pitch effectively for a while longer and choose not to?
Well, it was more or less my family.
Yeah.
To be honest with you. I mean, there was physical concerns, of course, but it was really more about my family and wanting to be there for my boys and my daughter, and my wife was, they were getting at the age where they needed to go out and they needed daddy being home a little bit more, and they needed to be able to do some things. They needed to be able to get out and start their career. And, you know, it was always about the my family.
Yeah.
You know, I think if it would have been really, I declared I was going to retire at the beginning of the season. And, you know, it would have been real easy to sit there, oh, you know what? You know, let me change my mind that I'm having a good year. And blah. Yeah. But nobody would have said a word if I'd have just sucked. You know, so it wasn't like it was one of those things where, you know, I decided, I'm going to ride out on top, because at that point I had no idea what the top was.
Hmm.
I didn't know how I was going to go this season. I mean, I remember talking when I went and told Bobby, I said, hey, they'd offer me a 2-year deal. And I told Bobby that it's probably about opening day. I walked in his office and I told him, hey, just want to let you know, I'm going to retire after this year.
Hmm.
You know, he's like, no, man, you're top of your game, da, 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 you know. But it's also, you know, it's what's best for not just myself, but for my family. Could I probably pitch another year? Probably.
Yeah.
But point being that, you know, this was about more than just me. And so, that's what it was about. And, you know, when I finished, it was great to be able to finish the way I did. But, I mean, I don't think I would have ever pictured going out quite that way and it working out that way. But, you know, I'm glad it did.
Great stuff on all fronts. And like I said, I love talking to someone with so much enthusiasm for what they do, whatever they do. And in your case, it's baseball. So much respect to you for your career and also for the great job that you're doing coaching at the Miller School, and I very much appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Oh, hey, well, I appreciate it. Thank you, Jim.